This is the Gender Card Podcast from Griffith University's Gender Equality Research Network. I'm Nance Haxton, and together we will speak to the vanguard of remarkable researchers breaking down the issues of gender equality, women's leadership, and gender inclusivity in all realms of life. Today, in this special episode of the Gender Card, celebrating World Refugee Day, we walk through the multicultural streets of inner city Brisbane with local community leader Seble Tedese. And later in the program, we find out how the United Nations 1951 Refugee Convention is being challenged around the world by speaking to two experts from Griffith University's Gender Equality Research Network, Emma Robinson and Tu Nguyen. As part of these discussions, we talk about family violence and the violence that refugees sometimes experience and flee. If you need to seek counselling after listening to this, please call 1-800-RESPECT or Lifeline. But firstly, we go to the Addis Coffee Shop on the main street of Moorooka to meet the Managing Director of South's Community Hub. Seble Tedese's community development work has helped hundreds of refugee families settle into their new Brisbane home. And now her expertise in family and domestic violence intervention and prevention in the refugee community is being recognised by being part of the Queensland Government's consultations for implementing coercive control legislation. Let's meet Seble at Addis Coffee while we wait for the special Ethiopian coffee ceremony complete with incense to come to our table. As Seble describes it herself, it is a business with a purpose.
My name is Seble Orktadese, but people call me Seble shortly. I'm a manager of the South Community Hub. The South Community Hub is doing the domestic family violence prevention work and community development around Moorooka and across Brisbane when it comes to domestic family violence prevention work. Yeah.
Seble, thank you so much for joining us on the Gender Card Podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah. For this World Refugee Day, our special episode.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, Seble, can you tell us a bit about this wonderful coffee shop where we're sitting, where we can hear all the beautiful sounds of the coffee being made? Yeah. How did this evolve?
This evolved actually from 2015. We started opening this place as a community connection hub. With the aim of to bring a new emerging community and the main existing community to come a place kind of to be connect each other without any judgment. So the idea is Moorooka is very known for a new emerging community group who came as a migrant, refugee, humanitarian entrance. They build their life around here. So the strip in here, if you look at it from, like, it's not very long, but it just all the business, almost 85% of the business is owned by the African or Middle East and the emerging community groups.
I reckon I heard about three or four languages just walking up here today, actually.
Yes. So where we're sitting now, it's called Addis Coffee.
And look at this Addis Coffee. We've got the beautiful, proper Ethiopian coffee sitting in front of us.
Yeah, this is typical coffee in Ethiopia. Is very much where I am belong.
Thank you for sharing this wonderful ceremony with us, and something that we don't see very often in Australian coffee shops, but some beautiful popcorn to go with it.
I know, that's very weird, isn't it? But yeah, because just normally you make always extra, so all the person neighborhood cross by, they will get a small amount. Maybe they didn't have food or they didn't have anything, so they should have something before they drink.
It's also a really important safe space
for
the community.
Yes, it's a safe space. As I said, let's create something where both cultures can get a place to have their own and connection. Connection is really important, and connection gives you belonging. We were overwhelmed with the need. People both sides of the community want to come and they enjoy it. But beyond that, we are actually also creating it for women who are coming here to shop around their, groceries and stuff, their, traditional thing. If they feel to come and talk, if they have any relationship or any issue, they can raise it. And our beautiful lady Addis Salem, she is also the owner of the business, but we do the service side of it. She is the owner of the business, and which is also trained in terms of the counseling and just referring to us. So it's kind of a safe space, both. Yeah.
That's wonderful. So, thank you. And we're pouring the coffee. Fantastic. I wish all my interviews were like this. Yeah. It obviously was following up a bit of a community need, that women needed a place to come, was it?
Yes, because the mainstream, and some of them, the language problem, some of them are misunderstanding, and some of them just not comfortable to go, and they don't think actually the other mainstream service is actually understand them. So in here they can understand, they can speak the language, two, three languages spoken in here, Tigrinya, Amharic, or Arabic, so they can actually communicate with that just easily. But also kind of some of them, they don't want to be referred, they just want to get someone to talk, not necessarily that. And also in the shop now, since we start the food, that actually we employ the vulnerable women who are in a bridging visa or seeking asylum or just recently break up, they never been in a workspace, and young people who can't get even apprenticeship, so giving that. So that's kind of, you know, the business we run with a purpose. Yeah.
And it's wonderful that you made such a difference in that time. Have you been able to see the difference in the community by having a place that people could come and actually be referred on?
Oh yes, we are like amazingly. The growth we have in that, and we receive actually positive feedback because they feel like, oh, just unintended conversation, and also we work with Maine also kind of to change the behavior, so the kind of I purposely raise some topics for them to talk about, and then just kind of they didn't think they are actually being challenged, but I challenge their masculinity and gender, and very big topic, but in a very safe space. So that's something, again, the change you will see it in the long term, but we know this is okay to talk. No one judging you. As I said, coffee is a place of no one judging you. They are here for coffee. They're just here not for any program. They're just here just to have their just kind of relaxing space. But we bring that topic in there when they are relaxed, rather than kind of being, you know, you are a problem and we are challenging you. No, actually, how can we change? Because we know 99%+ of the men are causing the domestic family violence. And how can we just, we know this is actually embedded with masculinity, how you see your manhood, and we know some from the culture space, we know many of men being conditioned that way because they are expected to perform, not because they want to, but the cultural upbringing, men is the house of the head, they have to be fight, being strong and fighter, you know, that violent culture, without their consciousness, they've been embedded in their thinking.
So really hard to stop that.
Yes, so for us is to reflect them, to think and go deep down their thinking. It's like, you know, oh, this, why, this is a women country. And I was like, no, this is a country for all human beings. But the law we have is respecting all human beings. Many of the women, they want to keep the relationship. They love their man, but they can't handle any more the violence. And they want that to stop. Sometimes, you know, we have like 6-7 men and a small, you know, they eat alone and stuff, and then just slowly they merge to the conversation. So yeah, again, we know this kind of thing, it takes time to change the thinking, but we are seeding the thinking, okay, it's my behavior actually causing, not necessarily about the women right or men right kind of thing, and not being oppressed men, because the law is protecting everyone as a human. It's based on the human right. So but sometimes they feel they've been kind of punished their manhood, but we know the law is not punishing manhood. The law is punishing those who are acting, deliberately choose a behavior to harm the other person, which is in this case women and children.
I'd like to talk about, you spoke at a panel for State Parliament. Could you tell us about that? That's really exciting, and the work you're doing in that coercive control space.
Yes. I think the network, it's called Coercive Control Network Meeting, which is a series of meetings happening since the Queensland government actually opened up for possible to legislate the coercive control as a standalone criminal code, or also embedded with others. So it's kind of, there is a task force who has been formed, and then they do this serious meeting with a DV Connect and White Srebrenica. We had that conversation, just showing how it's really important that, and also the women who are survive. I'm talking about those people or men who deliberately choose to be violent in a way. They know they don't want to go to call like a prison or anything. They know if they hit, they will be in trouble. They will get in prison. So they actually making their life miserable, and then they painting them as if they are actually betraying the community, betraying the culture, bad women, you know. And they use this to damage the women. Often they just spy them, and then they just telling them, you know, I'm watching you. So the women actually, even if they left physically from the relationship, they're not actually free of violence.
That coercive control continues.
Exactly. Especially some young children under 10, they use the children need of being with their dad to control by rejecting the children or just kind of saying things bad about the women, the mother. So it's mental, is also part of our body. Why don't it is being hurted by this person who choose to be deliberately to damage other persons mentally. So coercive control is, it is time. I know in Ireland and Scotland, they did have this law. Because of that, there is men actually think twice, and then the consequence, and then they can't start change their behavior.
How valuable, Seble, that you were able to give this perspective from the core community, from refugees,
yeah,
to this coercive control,
yeah,
debate. Because from what you've explained, there are really different ways that coercive control is expressed, even within cultures.
Yes, yeah, it is. Because, for example, the experience I have is like in the cultural space, the refugee migrant community group, they just came. I prefer using for those community, new emerging community group, because they are merging to the wider community, because Australia is a kind of emerging society. The indigenous people, the settler, the colonizer and stuff, we are now new emerging community. So we are trying to create a great, beautiful country, peace. It's like women or men or any kind of human being to live in peace. That is what we want as aspiration, as a society. But we know when the new community comes, the refugee, for example, their own refugee background also has impact, especially those who experience in a very extreme torture, war, violent is part of their kind of everyday living in a way when before they came in here. There is often the women, sometimes they just become, okay, I went through that one, I can go through this kind of thinking. And because of that, they don't seek support or they're accepting it. So we need to educate them, because if we want to be free of violence and community to all kind of, we need to make sure that cycle is not any longer passing to the second generation. Women maybe just kind of get used to it. I can deal it with it until I die, because they survive. Refugees are the survivors. They survive from war. They survive from torture. They survive from the rape through war. So these are the survival. So it's a different experience. Someone who born and grow up in here, not having that experience. The outcome is the same, but the experience is different. So it's important education to be in place if we are looking at the next generation to be free of violence. Because if we don't work now, the violence, we know it's a cycle. It's around 51% from my data I have in top of is 51%. Those who are experiencing in the family violence in their childhood, most likely they repeat it. So for us, it's really important. We develop myself and my other partner agencies like South Community, Multicultural Australia, Refugee Legal Service. In partner the last 4 years, we developed this family peace building training for leaders and community organizations, but also community members to be cultural way. How can we actually continue having at peace as a family, as a community? So we are by creating a peace builder in each community in their own language.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's been working?
Yes, it's excellent. The second round, now the first graduate was happening in last October. The second graduate will be happening in July next month. And total, we actually produce now the peace builders, around 28 peace builders. So they actually, the feedback we received is like it's transformed how they support their community. Many of migrant refugee backgrounds, they came from the collective culture. And we know the family violence, you can only address it if you are actually using the collective approach. Before, in the indigenous, you know, the mainstream Australia, this individual culture. But we know when the families break down, it's not only that individual's problem, it is a community's problem, it is a family, the extended family. As a nation itself, we suffer from it. So it needs to be approached, that collective approach, which can be actually our system, the, you know, the practice we are developing now can be even adopted for a wider community. We are hoping that. So, yeah, it's really, really good. We're doing, yeah.
Well, I think we should have a little bit of our coffee and maybe pick up again on our conversation outside. But thank you. This is fascinating. You were saying before, Seble, that you've actually been active in settling people in this space for a long time as well.
Yes. I've been a settlement case manager for almost 9 years until 2018. Before I start fully dedicate myself for the domestic family violence work. So settling newly arrived people from the day they arrive, from like 6 months onward, so that for 5 years I was, they are eligible for that service. And in total, before I left that job, I count how many people, because I have the caseload, and I assist actually more than 800 people. So the family, I had one of my clients, which she came, it's an amazing story, and I love talking about her, because she's a highlight. She came with 17 children. 17. And because she adopted her siblings, like a brother, sister, children, her nephews and niece, because she's originally from Congo, she's a survivor. Mm-hmm. All her house and village was burned down. She and her niece and nephews was being escaped because they were being under hiding themselves, so they managed actually escaping, so there's no one left. And she run and until they in they get themselves in South Africa. So her journey makes me always the strings she I learn every day through my other that work, because seeing the resilience, the energy, the kindness, you know, it's a very traumatized space. But she held on that, and then she came and settled in Australia, and then she was my client, and it was hard for me to find her a house to keep all the family together. But she always positive. I mean, it makes me like, you know, these are the story, like, how fragile we are sometimes. We're complaining everything, but I have women who thankful. Yes, that's my story. Yes, that's painful, but I have much better life in here. I look forward. I raise my children. They're not complaining. Yes, they have experience of refugee, but they are not any longer refugee. This is their home. They want to be feel this. They don't like always to be boxed in that. And they telling me often, it's like, I'm not anymore refuge. I am, this is my home. Don't remind me, I'm always, yes, I have that experience, but this is the home I made. Space, yeah.
And how about for you, Seba? Can I ask, you tell us a little bit about your journey as well, how you ended up working with refugees here in Australia?
Yes, I came in Australia 2009. Myself, I was been working in Amnesty International at the Uganda African office. And I was just shortly, because I left Ethiopia because of my activism. I'm a kind of a person, when I see injustice, I can't stand it. And very early age, and I started my activism in the university, because we had a dictator government at the time. They tried to dictate all our learnings. So in academic space, we couldn't even think out of the box. And then the teachers are in fear, the children are, like the student also sometimes been, you know, if you ask too much question criticizing the government, you've been spied by. And then I was like, no, we can't stand this. And we just start the revolution. And then some of us been kicked off from the university because we too much voice. And then luckily I'm from one of the privileged family, which they afford to pay a private university. And then I finished my university privately. And then I joined called the coalition movement. That's the movement, okay, now you know what? We have to change the government. We thought we will change the academic space only. Now it's a systematical problem. So in 2005, the movement turned to become a political party. So just for a sake of to make it that government to be accountable and the law to be changed. To surprise for ourselves, and also we did really, most of us young people, academicians, our professors in the university join us, so we the coalition party won the 2005 election. The government wasn't ready to give the power or to share even power. So all of us pretty much was been imprisoned for 2 years. And they, especially the Addis, hometown Addis Ababa is where I born and grew up in there. So we landslide the whole seat. And Addis, they panic because that's also the African Union seat. It is the capital city of the country. It's also the EU center for Africa. So they couldn't handle that. So I end up in prison and yeah, and then I just realized it's bigger than what I would expect. The change is not easy, especially, and then they crack down the international community, the Al-Qaeda and other things, because we are in the region, Ethiopia is in the region of the Middle East and Horn Africa, so always it's kind of issue. We couldn't really, they released us free because the people just kind of protest for us. And I was one of the four young leaders at the time. And I said, yeah, we can't change this vision. And I'm not wasting my other year. Because after 2 weeks, I learned they try to appealing again to put us in prison because we didn't quiet in as I expected that we'd just shut up and live your life. But I was actually more aggressive. Aggressive in a sense, like, yeah, we need to actually throw it. Not only change it, because they're not ready for change. So that activism led me to leave the country for a short period, and I got a job in Kampala. I was hoping to go back, actually not been, and then I continued my activism. I was being a campaign assistance for human rights defenders in the Horn Africa, so one of Ethiopia. So we defend the defenders, the human rights defenders in their own home country. So Amnesty was being banned in Ethiopia and other countries. So. And then that activism actually led the government armies was long. So twice I was been tried to be assassinated. So the Uganda government and Amnesty International, as I say, we can't anymore guarantee your safety. So I have to be somewhere. I was like, oh, what? Okay, yeah. Now I have to, for sure, I have to travel somewhere. And there is two options. One is Canada, one is Australia. So.
Well, how lucky is Australia that we got you?
Yeah,
in an awful circumstance.
And I love it. I love it. I love Brisbane. And I can't change. I travel a few places in Melbourne, Sydney, but I can't change. I love my Brisbane home.
Great.
Call Brisbane home. And that's why I'm active in refugee space and also the migrants and also injustice in general. I can't stand that. That actually, what I find in here, the open arm of Australia gave me home and gave me my husband and my children. So I met my husband here. So
Beautiful. It's
my home. Yeah.
Look, thank you so much for joining us on the Gender Card podcast today. And I want to encourage people to come to the coffee shop, things like that. And you touched on it before. So people should come and meet you and come into the coffee shop space.
Yeah.
This is a place they're welcome. We don't have... We shouldn't be hesitant and go, oh, no, this is where only refugee... This is only where called communities go, or migrants come to.
As I said, I love calling the new emerging community group. So we have to merge each other. Yes. And it's beautiful. We have a beautiful country. And we, rather than fear, let's explore the opportunity which bringing, the culture, the resilience. As I say, the coffee culture, for example, that a communal approach. For example, the issue we have in the domestic family violence, in other issues, we need to come as a community, that a collective approach. And many new emerging community groups have that embedded in their thinking. Use that for addressing those issues, rather than struggling, mumbling, or what to do, you know? So it is a place, a connection. For me, connection is important. We shouldn't be fear each other. We, in the future, my children now 9 and 6, this is their country. I want them the country where actually embrace in a way our uniqueness, coming from different parts, and we form one big country, beautiful country. It's a welcoming space. So that's at this coffee, which the coffee shop we have is, as you see it, all kind of culture is exchanging. And coming, and there's no fear. We shouldn't be. We all are human. At the end of the day, we are one race. That is a human race. The other thing is just like a closely change it again. from different things. Or as, like I call it, as a river, I love the water metaphor. I use it for, you know, water is water. It's, you know, one substance. But when it's in the lake, we call it lake. You know, when it flow, it's river. When you get it in the ocean, you know, in that wider space, in, still it's water. We maybe change, we have different color, we may have different shapes, different experience, but we all are human race. At the end of the day, that makes us common. You want something, you want to be happy, you want to be having a better life. Everyone wants that. As a human race, we need that. So we need to work for our common good rather than fear and fighting. We shouldn't allow those who exploiting our difference for their and then creating a conflict between. Shouldn't be, because Australia will be much, much better place if they're actually not wasting the skills from the new emerging community groups.
That was Seble Tedese, the Managing Director of South's Community Hub. World Refugee Day on June 20th every year is an international day designated by the United Nations to honour refugees around the world. It was held globally for the first time on June 20th, 2001, to commemorate the 50th anniversary of the 1951 Convention on the Status of Refugees. That convention is coming under increasing pressure, as our two PhD candidates from the Griffith Equality Research Network have discovered, in two vastly different areas of refugee policy. Emma Robinson is researching church sanctuary for asylum seekers, investigating fascinating historical, international, and modern examples of sanctuary movements around the world, featuring courageous nuns and church leaders taking a stance for refugees falling through the cracks of immigration enforcement. While Tu Nguyen is researching how regional protection is needed for the Rohingya refugees from Myanmar, who are now spread throughout Southeast Asia. Both have found that the new term of irregular migrant is being used to block asylum seekers from accessing basic services such as education, healthcare, and employment.
So my name is Tu Nguyen and I'm doing my PhD at School of Governments and International Relations at Griffith University.
My name is Emma Robinson and I am a lecturer and a PhD candidate at the law school at Griffith University.
And thank you both for joining the Gender Card.
Thank you.
Wonderful to see you today and to discuss the importance of World Refugee Day. What a day to discuss your really important research that you're both doing in your PhD. Emma, perhaps if we can start with yourself, if you can tell us a bit about this concept of church sanctuary. This is actually quite interesting at the moment, I think, in the context of quite a bit of refugee policy happening in Australia.
Yeah, well, I probably learnt about church sanctuary quite late in my sort of work and interest in refugee law in Australia. And that was in 2016 when a network of churches across Australia declared themselves as places of sanctuary for a group of asylum seekers who had been transferred to Australia for medical reasons from an offshore processing facility.
I'd forgotten about that. That is not that long ago,
yeah.
Is it?
Yeah, and I remember thinking, what? Sanctuary? You know, what is this? And it sounded kind of like something out of a movie, and I was just instantly fascinated. And I think what fascinates me is that even in our very, I guess, secular society, that churches would have this power.
So what are you looking at now? Is there other countries that have this tradition of church sanctuary as well?
Yeah, I started to do a little bit of research around it, and Germany has an effective, small but effective church sanctuary movement, as does Canada, actually. I was particularly interested in Germany because I'd already done a little bit of research on the changes to the asylum laws in Germany in the early 90s. So I wanted to learn more about, and also, I guess, given Germany's history with respect to persecution, I thought that was particularly interesting to look at. You know, is that one of the reasons why the church sanctuary movement is so effective in Germany? And I wanted to sort of, I guess, start a comparative study of, well, why has it worked there and what are the conditions in which it's been effective and what can Australia learn from that? Mm. Because there is sort of an agreement. It's not a legal agreement in the sense that it hasn't been sort of legislated for, but there is an agreement between the government and the heads of the major churches in Germany for if a certain process is followed, then the government will not intervene to deport a person who has stepped into church sanctuary. But the parameters are very strict, and there have been recent court cases of where, you know, nuns or priests have been required to answer to the law because perhaps they're perceived as not having followed that process. But it is an effective process in that there is that the government tolerates it and will look at a case again if certain criteria are met.
And what about for Canada? Have there been interesting precedents there too?
Oh, yes. As again, I haven't done as much research in Canada, but in a sense there are more articles and more research on Canada in English-speaking journals. So Canada has had a very effective movement. And in fact, we should also mention the sanctuary movements in the US. And there was in the 80s, there was a really big movement there with the cross-border movements, and a number of churches along the Mexico-US border actually provided sanctuary for refugees who were trying to flee into the US. And I actually think, in fact, that that's how the German church sanctuary movement started, or the modern one. But there is a long history of it going back to medieval times, Roman times, Greek times, and even before that for sanctuary. So I have been interested to see the roots of that and, you know, is this a humanitarian response that has found an outlet in the church, but it's actually universal and it doesn't necessarily need to be tied to any particular religion, but simply a response where power structures are so inflexible that this sort of human need to show compassion and to help others finds ways to express itself when the prevailing power structures of the government become so inflexible that that compassion or that help is needed.
How interesting, because I know I think of church sanctuary as something from like an 18th century novel.
Or,
you know, it sounds so dated, but it really is quite contemporary.
Yes.
It's had a revival in a sense, has it?
It has. Mm. And not only church sanctuary, but obviously, you know, anyone who does a PhD realizes pretty quickly that they need to keep it pretty narrow. You know, there are wider sanctuary movements as well. There's the city sanctuary movements, which are taking place in places like the UK, Canada, where cities will actually declare themselves places of sanctuary for asylum seekers. And also there's something called citizen sanctuary as well. So this movement is not just confined to churches and it's not just a Christian necessarily movement, but that is one of the places where this response or this revival is occurring.
So did you see any changes or developments in COVID, or is it a bit, we're still in COVID really, aren't we, particularly around the world, but did you notice any trends there?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, for anyone who is actually physically in church sanctuary in Germany, it's probably because they can't actually physically leave the church grounds, they're in a perfect position to take all the COVID precautions. It's very a different thing altogether for refugees in refugee camps, obviously, where I think COVID would be just one of the very many health issues that are there. And I was listening to a podcast, a UN podcast, and the UN rep in Yemen said that, you know, when the UN was sort of giving them directives to make sure refugees are taking precautions, and he just said, this is just unrealistic. You know, there's the Western perspective of COVID responses, and then there's the unrealistic expectations that anyone in a refugee camp can get water, for example. You know, when you have to walk 5 kilometres every day to get water, then you're probably more likely, it's not realistic to say you need to be constantly washing your hands because you'll be wanting to save that water to drink. Or, you know, instead of maybe spending your money on a bar of soap, of course you would spend the money on rice to eat. So in that sense, it has been really difficult for refugees.
I think this is a good time to move to yourself as well. Can you tell us about your research and what you've discovered regarding the Rohingya community? This is something that I think we heard a bit about in the news, but it seems to have slipped off the radar in Australia. So I'm very interested to hear what has been happening here.
Thank you, Nez. Thanks for having me again. So my PhD research basically study the refugee protection for Rohingya, who is the stateless minorities from Myanmar and who have been suffering from the state persecutions by the Myanmar government. So my research is trying to find out what is the impediment to the developments of the regional refugee protection mechanism for the Rohingya refugees. The research is trying to look into different levels of response, international, regional, and local governments towards refugee protection and providing the protection that they deserve at the refugees. And it's interesting to see why research in regional refugee protection mechanisms that matters. Because when it comes to refugee protections, it's the state responsibility to provide protections according to the 1951 conventions of the United Nations. However, the study on forced displacement recently shows that this convention itself have some limitations. Basically because of its inabilities to deal with new drivers of displacement like climate change or economic deprivations. And there has been ideas for the reforms to take by adopting a new definition of refugees, just to get a new prudent one to include a new kind of refugees in the world. Or even there's some ideas like taking the international human right law as the highest standard for the refugee protections, you know, because no countries can run from that. However, in another school of thought, because and this is what my research is based on, that it's not the conventions that's a problem, but it's implementations due to its political natures of the international law. So, because there is no universal treaties that can address all of the concerns. So even we come up with a new definition, it cannot address all of the concerns of the refugee protections. So that has been a suggestion of a relevant approach by taking the soft law approach, or strengthening bilaterals or regional arrangements in order to manage the forced displacements and provide the refugee protections. So that's why in my research, I'm trying to find what is the impediment for the regional corporations in providing refugee protection for the Rohingya peoples, even though before the crisis happened in 2012, there was actually some kind of regional mechanism before in 2011 through the adoption of the Regional Cooperation Framework, the ICF. Or in 2013, there was the Bali Declarations. But none of these proposals was turned into concrete action, you know. So why is that?
What an interesting debate as well about the actual convention for refugees, which is held up in such esteem, obviously, but that there are people saying perhaps it needs to be changed or more. Is it the application? That must be quite interesting for you to really to look into. What have you found by delving into that? Do you think it is more about how it's applied that is important?
The legal tool is still very important. And even though it itself has some challenging in implementation, you know, it's good when it comes to different contexts in different continents, the regional organization is different. So the thing is, we need to adapt. So that's why my research look into how the international refugee laws that localize in Southeast Asia, because Southeast Asia is quite different when it comes to refugee protection. ASEAN is quite different because in ASEAN, the story is always about the non-interference principles. So refugee has never been on the agendas of the regional meetings.
So ASEAN has always been a bit hands-off when it comes to refugees.
Yes, 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 it is. And they always trying to avoid to address the refugee protection, refugees at the political affairs. Mm-hmm. And they trying, what I have found in my research is they trying to frame the refugees as the victim of human trafficking. And in this way, somehow they're trying to avoid providing the refugee protection that these people deserve to get.
So by saying that they're all victims of human trafficking, mm-hmm. they're trying to absolve their responsibilities in a way, would you say?
One thing too, when you were speaking about, the effectiveness of the UN Refugee Convention, yeah. It's a huge issue. But I think it's also important to realise, I'm just sort of brought up some stats here. The latest UNHCR report on global displacement figures actually shows that at least 79.5 million people around the world have been forced to flee their homes. Now, that's for the first time, it's been steadily increasing over the years. Mm. For the first time, that is now 1% of the world's population who have fled their homes due to conflict and persecution. Mm-hmm. Now, of that huge number, there are about 26 million who are considered to be refugees under the definition of the UN Refugee Convention. So that remaining may not technically meet that definition, but there was a reason. They have fled their homes because it was unsafe for them to be there. Now, it may not meet that narrow definition that it was because of their political opinion, their ethnicity, their religion, but there are other reasons that you have mentioned, economic reasons, climate reasons, civil war. So, you know, that UN Refugee Convention has been an effective tool in many ways, but as you've said, there are so many other things that need to be put into place to recognize
that's why we need the role of the regional organization to jump in, you know, because there would be...
So ASEAN, you think, should be taking more of a leadership role here?
Yes, because there should be some other options that they can take by the regional organization. Because what happens if these people are excluded from the refugee definitions and they are considered as irregular migrant?
Irregular migrant. Yes. That's the classification
that's
for
what,
them.
That's what happened in ASEAN through the case of Rohingya.
And what does mean for them?
Yes, and this labelling is very sensitive and consequential, because if these people are considered irregular migrants, that means they cannot get the right to work legally. Right? Irregular migrants cannot, but refugees, they have the rights. So that means they end up being in the black economies that people say, unregistered, unknown, right? So they cannot have access to basic services like healthcare, education, employment. So and also some of them also suffer from detention and abuses practices by the immigration authorities and police, and that's, you know, that is even make their life is more miserable than in the refugee camp.
I mean, refugees have so little rights already, it sounds like, but if you're given one of these other categories, you've got even less rights again.
Exactly. Thanks for making it
that
way.
And these are the countries that the Australian government says, well, we're stopping the boats. Mm. What they're actually doing is sending these asylum seekers back to those countries where they will be considered irregular migrants. So
what's our responsibility in that?
What is our responsibility? I think you know, we should be doing a lot more.
So Rohingyas, it's quite a very recent refugee crisis in a way, isn't it? I mean, there's been a few, obviously, over the years, but it's developed a lot as well, the Rohingyas. Where are so many of them now? All throughout Asia, I think you mentioned?
Yeah, I think they migrate from Burma to mainly Bangladesh and India's neighboring countries, and also to some Muslim country in Southeast Asia.
So to Malaysia, Indonesia there as well?
Thailand, Malaysia and Indonesia. And the thing is, they are now in protected situation. So their life is on the holding time, waiting for their application to be processed, and with no options to be considered, and their life becomes so uncertain. And by principle, according to the 1951 convention, they will have three durable solutions. Either they can be returned to their country of origin in Myanmar, if the conditions are conducive for repatriation to be implemented. But actually, it is not, according to many reports by regional non-government organizations, not by the Myanmar government. And either they can be integrated into the local communities in the country they come to, like Thailand, Malaysia, Indonesia. But, you know, when COVID comes, there is a distinction between the insider and outsider, and makes them prone to more, you know, harsh discrimination.
Very vulnerable.
Vulnerable, yeah.
So what about the impact of COVID? You mentioned it briefly there in your answer, but what impact has that had now on this Rohingya community spread throughout Asia?
I think managing the maritime migration itself is a challenge. And with COVID, when countries shutting down their borders, it just make the maritime migration more complex. So the principle of non-refoulement is a norm in customary international law that prevents states from sending refugees back to the place where they will face persecutions. But during COVID, the states, they prioritize the sovereignty responsibility through restrictive measures over human rights of non-refoulement and rescue at sea. So what that can be seen during in the news is that what happened during Rohingya is in Malaysia, I think in June last year, a boat carrying more than 300 of Rohingya refugees, they were pushed back by the Malaysian government into international waters, and they cannot turn back because their engine broke down. Mm. So after that, the Malaysian authorities, they detained these people, and they was planning to send these people back to international waters after the engine was fixed. So this actually violates the principle of non-refoulement. And this is not to mention there was a lot of them die on the ways in the journeys, stranded at sea for months before they are rescued. And during the protected situation, you know, women's refugees, they are prone to abuses practices by the police. And also they are become the victims of sexual violence, especially by other refugees in the refugee camp. So apparently, refugees are among the vulnerable groups, and women's refugees, I can say children and women refugees, is the most vulnerable group.
The most vulnerable of that vulnerable group, as you say.
And I think that's often the biggest block, that people don't understand that a refugee or an asylum seeker could be any one of us if we found ourselves in different conditions, and just understanding and creating that connection that actually this is another human being, I think opens up those doors of understanding and compassion. And
sounds like quite an area of your particular passion, dare I say, Emma, I think an interest. What do you think caused you to go down this research path?
There could be some deep psychological issues.
But you had the experience in that area as well, working as well?
Definitely working at the Refugee and Immigration Legal Service before I came to Griffith. But I mean, I think there are many young girls, perhaps, who read The Diary of Anne Frank and experience a sense of disbelief that something like that could happen, and also a sense of injustice. And certainly that's what has always drawn me to that area of how could we not give someone a safe place if their life was at danger? You know, that to me, this sort of nationalistic fabrication of borders. I understand there are practical reasons why we have borders, but when those are wielded as weapons against the most vulnerable people, I think they are not serving the purpose, you know, for which they're there. And that's, to me, what it boils down to.
What about for you two? What was your motivation for researching the Rohingya?
Right. Thanks for asking these questions. Because more people will ask, what are you studying, rather than asking, why do I study this? So thanks for asking this again. So I'm from Vietnam, and there's a lot of Vietnamese boat peoples coming to Australia and, you know, Australian, United States. So I'm quite familiar with the terms boat people. And when I was doing my master in Bangkok in 2014, I was introduced to Rohingya peoples by regional NGOs. And I was there witnessing the regional voice and regional activisms to protect these people. And I think I should take this opportunity to thank these NGOs, the Asian Resource Foundation, Asian Muslim Action Network, for making an impression on me about that. And when I think about the refugees and the boat peoples, you know, so I think it has been more than 40 years since the boat peoples of the Indo-Chinese refugee crisis after Vietnam War is coming and happened. And with the regional ASEAN regionalism in progress, with the proliferation of human rights in the world, so why are we still so ill-equipped to deal with a refugee crisis?
Oh, it's so true. So ill-equipped. It's a very apt description of it, isn't it? 40 years ago, it's hard to believe. And how much has changed in that time? We're still struggling with this.
That's true.
Well, thank you for joining us on the Gender Card today. I suppose to close, could we maybe just think about what are your hopes that come out of this research? Do you have a hope for refugee policy in the future? It just seems such a despairing area in some ways, but have you seen progress? What do you think, Emma?
From an Australian government point of view, the government is only going to change their stance when the Australian population shows them that they don't want the current policies. And, you know, movements like that behind the Bilawila family are really important to show the government that they're not completely 100% backed in terms of their harsh measures. So I'm hopeful that we will find, as we learn more about the conditions that these people flee from, that we will find a broader, higher percentage of our population who are not as fearful of more generous refugee or asylum seeker policies by our government, and that will be the main thing that changes our policies, because it's, you know, it's a national shame for us.
Well, what about for you to do? Hold hope for the Rohingya? It seems such an intractable situation. Is there progress?
I think the big problem now for the response towards the Rohingya refugees is how these institutions come together. So together is a big problem for them, because there has been, in my research, inconsistencies in response and coordination between international institutions. The UN, UN Security Council, UN General Assembly, UNHCR, and the UN country team in Myanmar. There are also inconsistencies between the ASEAN, the AICHAS, ASEAN Intergovernmental Commission of Human Rights, and also regional non-government organizations. And also, there is also inconsistence in the response by local governments at different creatures. So I think what I hope for is how these organizations can come together as having the common voice, you know, for the refugee protections. Because I think when we can agree with each other on a common solution with the political determinations, then hopefully there will be a solution for them. Even that we can come up with a fourth solution, you know, in addition to the three traditional durable solutions. Maybe we hope that we can still have a, you know, creation for them.
It's true. Look, thank you very much for coming and joining us on the Gender Card.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
That was PhD candidates Tu Nguyen and Emma Robinson. And that's all for this episode of The Gender Card. This podcast was produced for the Gender Equality Research Network by Nance Haxton, with production assistance from Michael Adams. Stay up to date with this Griffith University podcast on SoundCloud. Speak to you again soon.